Welcome, welcome everyone to another episode of the Bastards of Boston Baseball, bringing you another episode of Clown Takes. And we've certainly got some people to direct our ire at this week once again. I am your host, Jason Kelly, coming to you from Canton, Massachusetts. You can find me on Twitter at Color of the Iris. Joining me on the show from Boca Raton, Florida, by way of Centerville, Mass, is Jeremy Schilling. Jeremy, how are you?
I'm excited to be here. It's glad to be back. I had fun with the previous episodes, and I'm looking forward to this one as well.
Nice. And where can people find you on Twitter, just real quick?
Wow, didn't expect that. I think it's jshill20. You put me on the spot there, man. That wasn't fair.
My bad, yeah.
we didn't do it last show.
I think it's jshill20. I'm not exactly sure, but it is jtschill20.
All right, cool. Also with us on the show is Terry Cushman. Terry, how you doing?
Oh, just invigorated to do this second episode, and especially the guy I'm going to be clowning.
Yeah, I can tell you kind of just jumping out of your seat a little bit there. So, but yeah, as you know, we've done only one of these episodes before, so just to briefly kind of recap the format here, it's basically just, look, people say a lot of stuff on Twitter, us included. I certainly got roasted for my fair share on Twitter this week for my Javier Baez tweet. So we can take it, but we can also dish it out. And we've certainly got some people to call out this week. So I'm just going to go right ahead and toss it over to Terry. The floor is yours. You're in the leadoff spot here. Go for it.
So the person I'm going to be clowning this week is a former host of this podcast. That would be Andrew Dwan. He spent 3.5 years with us. So that's like 3.5 lifetimes, really. That's a long time to be on a podcast. And let me just kind of get to, I'm going to do some background on him a little bit further, but let's just get into the tweet. So every now and then, you know, I tweet something that ends up being a doozy, probably something that I shouldn't have, but you know, part of being on this crew is we're not politically correct, we're rough around the edges, and we're just as authentic, you know, as we can. So Trevor Story gets hurt last week. Within seconds, I tweeted out, I said, hard to tell what type of injury Trevor Story might have. I said, the gravity is more intense in Anaheim than Colorado, though. So I was a little frustrated in that moment because coming into the season, my expectations for Trevor Story, not that high. I was probably more worried about the performance aspect than the injury aspect, although in hindsight, I don't know why I wasn't worried about the injury aspect. But Andrew Dwan responds to that, and by the way, he didn't quote tweet me, so I didn't get the alert to have an opportunity to respond, you know, right away. He screenshotted it and then posted it, so I was completely unaware of it. Somebody had to show it to me, and I didn't even see it until mid-afternoon the next day because of that. So kind of cowardly there to go about it that way, but Andrew screenshots and says, this type of post doesn't even surprise me. Right after former Yankees coach Rachel Balcevic was hit in the face with a baseball and seriously hurt, he sent pictures of it with laughing emojis in the podcast chat. Glad Micah Storms got out of there. So I don't remember posting that in the chat. I probably did. It's something that I probably would do. And I mean, if anybody takes a ball to the face and they're not hospitalized, I'm probably going to laugh. If I took a ball to my face, I would post the picture with laughing emojis. You want to make fun of me? Wait 5 seconds. I'll make fun of myself. So, you know, as far as that goes, oh, and then as far as Micah leaving, you know, he didn't know the circumstances behind it. I'm sure he probably assumed there was some tension behind the scenes, maybe some infighting, and then, you know, Micah got out of there. couldn't be any further from the truth. Micah and I, we talked about, he had a problem with this show specifically. He was uncomfortable with this format. And, you know, I'm extremely hesitant to stray away from, you know, the path that's gotten us here. So he was a little uncomfortable with, you know, with the brand, and he moved on, but it was a very civil conversation, very cordial. And, you know, we both agreed to do what was best for the podcast, and he stepped away. And I told him, I said, the door, you know, is open for you to come back in the future if you're more comfortable with it at any point. So, you know, that's kind of where he went with that. And Micah immediately called him out for Andrew taking a shot at him 2 weeks before. I won't get into that, but you know, Micah wasn't really backing him at all. And just some background on Andrew. When he came into the podcast, I shouldn't say immediately, but not long after, he immediately started clashing with Charlie to the point where they weren't really on speaking terms for the rest of Andrew's tenure here. He didn't get along with Charlie. He didn't get along with Nick Face, who's our super utility guy. For whatever reason, took a lot of shots at him. As the Bloom era kind of endured and came to a tumultuous end, he and I were fighting quite a bit as well, and it spilled out of the war room and into public tweets. Okay, he only got along with two hosts on this show, like 40% of the show. Every time we'd have a spat, I'd be praying the next morning. I'd get a message in my DM saying, "Hey man, I'm leaving the crew. You know, nice knowing you." It never happened. It got to the point where I'm like, "Why are you here?" And when what ended up being our last spat, I didn't really know that night that was going to be the end of it. That was on a Tuesday. 2 days later, we were set to record, and that morning I was like, "You know what? I don't want to spend 2.5 hours with this guy tonight. And quite frankly, I don't want to do it ever again." So finally, I tossed him off the crew. And for much of his tenure here, the culture behind the scenes was pretty toxic. Extremely toxic at times. And the second he was bounced off, everything mellowed out and we went on to have our biggest season ever, you know, as a crew. And, you know, I don't miss him. And Andrew, you know, at least quote tweet us, give us a chance to respond in a timely manner. And, you know, your Twitter, like I said, is just, it's just a barrage of hate tweets against everybody that triggers you. That's all your account is about. So, you know, if that's the world you want to live in, so be it.
Jeremy, anything to add?
Well, Jason, considering that I'm planning on attacking Terry at multiple times, at least during the podcast, and I don't know anything about this situation, no.
That's fair. Yeah, no, that's totally fair. I guess for my part, yeah, like, admittedly, I was probably one of the few who I think did get along with Andrew. And I say get along, I mean, we hosted a show together once a week. So, you know, and he didn't publicly call me out on Twitter or anything like that. I'm sure he's probably wanted to, but I guess he hasn't yet. For me, it's the not quote tweeting and not just like adding the account when you have something to say. Because it's like, if you're going to tweet it publicly, then why not just at the account? Like, why go through the trouble of taking a screenshot and then posting it out there? And like, is he hoping that like we won't see? Is, you know, is it like, I don't, that part I never understand when people do that. And it's just kind of a weird move. So, and him kind of assuming that like Micah just couldn't wait to get out of here is really annoying too, because Micah was enjoying his time here and, you know, he was a good fit. And, you know, it was just a difference of philosophies, and he was very, you know, he manned up about it and had a conversation with Terry and, you know, owned it and said, "Look, I just can't do it, and that's the way it is, and that's okay." And, you know, we're we're still good with him. As you know, as Terry said, doors open. I don't think any of us would shake our heads if he ever wanted to come back for whatever reason or do a spot on a show or something. So, you know, it's tough in our position because we're not just going to do the podcast where we sit and like make cute nicknames for all the players and, you know, do these little gimmicks, you know, even when the Red Sox get their brains beat in, and we're just going to do these funny little gimmicks and, you know, make cute little nicknames and just laugh about it. Like, we do the podcast because we hold the team and the players accountable when they deserve it. And I never felt like Andrew was comfortable with that. I always felt like he you know, I don't know if it's because like he, I don't know, he felt like they would hear it and, you know, blackball him on Twitter or something. I don't know. But it's like, these guys aren't going to notice you. So it's like, you should hold them accountable. Like, it's just, it's the way it is. They're athletes. You hold athletes accountable as a podcast, as, you know, a show that, you know, kind of like what we do. I mean, he has the same problem with like the radio guys, like Felger and like, he hates Felger and Maz. He hates Solak and Bercher, and he hates all those guys. And all they do is pull massive ratings and they get a lot of people tuning into their show. Why? Because they do what we do. They hold the team accountable. They hold the players accountable. That's what Boston wants to hear. And maybe it's just, he's out of touch. I don't know how long it's been since he's been in Boston. He's been out in Colorado for a while. So maybe he's just out of touch with how Bostonians are and what they really want out of shows. But I just never felt like he was comfortable with us holding the team accountable and holding players accountable. And, you know, at this point it's like, dude, you left the show so long ago. Like, do you have anything better to do than just stalk the account and just pounce on the first thing that, you know, you want to disagree with? Like, it's getting a little sad. Like, dude, just, you know, let it go. We get it. You hate us. It's okay. It's okay. You can hate us. We got plenty of them, you know, line up next to them. But I don't know. The incessant tweeting and not like, you know, adding the account and not quote tweeting it's just a little bit of a weird move. I think that's kind of where I fall on that.
And another thing, he didn't follow me on Twitter. He didn't follow Charlie on Twitter. He's just this smugly angry guy. And I meant to include these. So when I'm thinking about putting a person on this crew, especially if we're doing the really rigorous process where we're going to have 3 or 4 finalists, I'll go through some of their tweets and just make sure there's nothing insane in there that's going to come back to bite us. And I didn't find anything insane with Andrew by any means, but he came onto the crew in late 2019, and I saw a couple of tweets here. And the only reason I'm bringing this up is because, you know, he threw the Rachel Balcovic thing at me. But so just about 2 years before he joined, November 2017, he tweets at JetBlue, the airline. He says, "Hey, at JetBlue, can I get a refund since this person is taking up half my seat? This is absurd." So it kind of, I can't read his mind. I can only speculate, but you know, it reads like there's a little bit of fat shaming there going on. Let's see. Not even 1 year later, so 8 months later, he says, "At Spirit Airlines, ought to be a rule about losing half your seat to the chick in the middle seat." So possibly fat shaming a female there. Another thing he could be doing is trying to get the flight for free. I don't know. And the JetBlue one, that JetBlue actually responded right away and said, "We're sorry you're uncomfortable. Please reach out to the in-flight crew members." And Andrew didn't respond after that. With the second tweet here with the chick in the middle seat, he kept subtweeting it and says, "Why am I paying for her extra space?" A few minutes later, "Signed up for the government free, not the person next to you spilling over the seat." And it just goes on and on. "My bag is taking up less space and using less gas, like a lot less. Why am I paying $65 for that and she's paid $81? I don't know. He's a strange dude. I saw those tweets when he came on and I'm like, you know. But, you know, he won, you know, the seat handily versus everyone he was, you know, he was matched up against. So not a guy I'd ever want to have a beer with. Let's put it that way.
I think that's fair. Yeah, I think that's fair. So I think what I'm going to do is, Jeremy, I'm going to save you for the end, because I think our two takes that we're going after kind of tie into each other.
Sure.
So I'm going to go after, and it's not sort of the official Red Sox account, because I don't actually think they tweeted it, but it's all the beat reporters that essentially tweeted it, and we knew it came from the team. I'm kind of clowning the Red Sox in general this week for them trying to claim that opening day was a sellout, because this is the kind of crap that annoys me about this team and this ownership group, is that we all saw that with our own eyes. It was not a sellout. There were chunks of empty seats throughout that stadium throughout the whole game. 98.5 during the game, in the middle of the game, actually went on RedSox.com and saw that there were tickets available for like $40 to go to that game, and like numerous tickets available. And it's just, again, it's like this happy horse crap that the Red Sox try to push on you. Like, oh, another sellout, America's favorite stadium, America's greatest ballpark, another sellout on opening day. And we're all sitting there going, you guys realize that the interest in this team has never been lower than it is right now going into this season because of your awful offseason, the back-to-back last place finishes, the manager doesn't want to be here and is going to bolt as soon as he gets a chance. Like, it's just, again, it's the same tone-deaf crap from this ownership group of just trying to be happy-go-lucky. Yep, it's another sellout, another great sellout on opening day when it clearly wasn't. People don't love going to the ballpark as much as they used to, and a lot of that's the product on the field. A lot of it, too, is the ballpark itself. It's just, I don't know, I just get so, like, annoyed when it's like, can you just be real? Can you, just tweet out what the actual attendance was? Don't try and sell us that, like, oh, it was a sellout on opening day. Just say, oh, we got this many people. Like, no one's going to care. No one's going to, like, laugh at you for not selling out. It's okay. It's when they tried to do that thing, you know, for years where it's like, well, we've had, you know, this many consecutive games that's been a sellout. And that was a lie, too. So it's just, stop lying. Stop pretending like everything is great, because it's clearly not, you know. And, like, it's easy, of course, to go on this rant now because the Red Sox just got their brains beat in for three games at home. But if they finish in last place again this year, I mean, at what point is ownership going to wake up and just really start to treat us like adults and not treat the fan base like they're idiots? Because that's what they do. It's, you know, lying about the sellout is kind of like a minor sort of thing towards that, but it's a grander picture of, you know, well, we're going to go full throttle. Oh, so you're going to sign a bunch of free agents? Oh, no, I meant we're going to go full throttle in terms of teaching defense. Sorry, that's what I meant. That was Tom Werner. And clearly that's worked out great. That's some full throttle defense we're seeing there. So I don't know. I'm just kind of clowning ownership in general for how they handle the products, how they handle the fan base, how they handle the city of Boston. They've completely lost touch. They've completely lost touch with the city, the fan base, and it shows. It reflects on the field with how the team performs. So it was, again, a minor thing about the sellout, but it just triggered like all this other stuff with them that I'm just like, I'm so sick of with this group. And it's just, I don't know. It needs to change. It needs to change big time. Terry, any thoughts on that?
Well, Jeremy can go first if you want.
Jeremy, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, you're teeing me up here because I have plenty to say. So there was once a time when John Henry stormed into 98.5 and confronted Felger and Maz. And there was a documentary. I don't remember what the platform was, but if you haven't seen it, go hunt it down and watch it. It's very entertaining. He cared at that moment. You can say what you want about the way he ran that particular season, but he cared. He cared enough to drive to 98.5, where they were headquartered at the time, and confront those two radio hosts. This sackless piece of... Terry says I can't swear.
You can say shit. Anything okay. PG-13.
This sackless piece of shit, okay? It's not lost on me that the Penguins won a big game tonight to hold the last playoff spot in the NHL wild card. Because I'm sure he cares about that, because he's paying Sidney Crosby. But he does not give a shit about the Red Sox. the Red Sox are an asset within his portfolio, and that is all he means to us. Where we care, we invest, we spend. You know, I'm a remote fan, so I spend on extra innings. I spend through my Hotwire account so that wherever I am, I can watch the Red Sox. I listen to 98.5. You know, I'm not buying merchandise this year, but typically I do. He is a sackless piece of shit. The fact that he's on the field crying during the Wakefield thing may have been genuine, but I don't see it as that because I think he's just that detached from what's important to the fan base, which is a product that we can root for and stand behind on a year-in, year-out basis, because right now it's an absolute dumpster fire. Now, we talked about this a little bit in a couple of recordings ago when we went through the Orioles series. They're trying to throw smoke and mirrors at us, okay? So they sign Bayo, which I agree with, and they sign Rafaela, which I tentatively agree with. But that is a smokescreen to avoid the bigger picture of looking at what they're doing to improve the big league roster today. Because signing Bayo and signing Rafaela are a long-term projection that will hopefully rear its head in many years from now, 2 to 5 years, to say that we're good now and look what we did 2 to 5 years ago. But what are they doing now? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Okay? They have lost touch with Red Sox Nation because they're pursuing other ventures, Roush Fenway, Liverpool, the hockey team, whatever the hell else they're involved in, which I know is other non-sports related, entertainment related ventures. And it absolutely pisses me off. And I think you are dead on with your criticism of this ownership group. And I'm going to touch on this more in my part of this segment.
Basically, look at the whole process to hire their new chief baseball officer. Literally 10 other well-respected, highly regarded candidates said no. And then Breslow comes in and, oh, wait a minute, you're not allowed to bring in any of your own guys. You're going to keep all the holdovers, every single one of them. Brian O'Halloran, Raquel Ferreira, Eddie Romero. It's the same crew that has been there for this steep nosedive that's happened since 2018. The mindset isn't fresh. You know, Breslow's brought in, they handcuffed him financially right out of the gates, and they've put him in an impossible situation to exceed. Having said that, I think he's definitely had some blunders, though. I mean, he probably could have traded Kenley Jansen at least to get the money off the books. Maybe he wouldn't have got the return he wanted, but there's definitely been a failure to execute on his part, but it's a perfect storm. And it's not going to change until we get an actual baseball executive in here who can bring in his own crew, guys he trusts, guys that he thinks are going to, you know, help, you know, collaborate with him to put that winning product on the field. And you're just not going to see it. And they can't even keep their narrative straight. You know, Sam Kennedy is, the dude's a politician and not a very good one. You know, so none of that's going to change until you have the right executives in there. I mean, the day Breslow took over, the cupboards in the minors were bare as far as pitching went. This pitching staff was no better than 4 years earlier when Heim Bloom took over. He did nothing for this organization as far as pitching. Breslow's brought in some people, and it hasn't worked so far. I mean, Campbell is, you know, had a rough go of it, and we'll see what happens with Criswell this weekend, but I don't think this current group of executives has the IQ or the ability to execute to get us back to where we were.
Jason, do you mind?
Go for it. Yeah.
Terry loves when I involve other sports, so that's what I'm going to do right now.
It's only the fourth reference in 90 minutes.
Yesterday, the Celtics signed Drew Holiday. 4 years, $135 million, when everyone thought it wasn't possible. And I know this isn't a Celtics broadcast, so I'm not going to get into it. But today I heard some commentary from Wick Grousbeck, who's the principal owner of the Boston Celtics. And he talked about investing in your roster, in your organization, to be competitive on a year-in, year-out basis, and to focus on the now. And I was... You know, I'm a fan of all four Boston sports teams, so it was relevant for the Celtics, but I'm preparing for my first podcast back with you guys, and I couldn't help but apply that to what the Boston Red Sox are doing. And it absolutely pisses me off. The Celtics are going all in. They don't care. They're signing Drew Holiday, They have Jason Tatum coming up, who's going to take $60 to $70 million a year to sign as an MVP candidate year in and year out. Still very young, max contract, super max, and again, wrong sport for this podcast. And we can't spend basically any money. No top-end talent, for sure. Maybe attempts to fill in the roster. We've talked about on other versions of this podcast, how the up-the-middle defense is completely no depth. It just, in a city that's so starved for consistent winning, they don't care. It makes you want to not care about this particular team in the city when it's so hard to not care. It absolutely pisses me off. Now, Terry commented on Breslow and how he's been strapped by who he wants to involve in the process, in the organization. I feel for Breslow. Okay, I didn't feel for Heim because Heim brought in his mentality. He brought in his plan. You know, he imposed his philosophy from the Devil Rays onto the Red Sox. That's not what's happening with Breslow. Breslow made comments in the offseason that he wanted to spend and build this roster. He is being handicapped by ownership. Now, Breslow wouldn't be here if the other 10 candidates would even take an interview, which a bunch of them wouldn't even take an interview, which is the most embarrassing thing you can go through, right? You're a Fortune 500 company or better, and there are people that are being asked to interview for a multi-million dollar position, and they won't even take the interview. It's abhorrent. It's absolutely embarrassing. And for that reason, I really don't hold Breslow responsible for much of what's going on right now. And I don't know how you can, because he's literally being handicapped. He's literally having hands tied behind his back, being told what to do, what not to do. And he's given a budget. I think somebody said $225. In the offseason, you guys can correct me if I'm wrong. And then we know he's being forced by ownership to even be below that. So I don't blame Breslow. I feel bad for the guy. He's put in a position where he's probably ruining his career by even being here, because he's going to be limited in his future employment because he can't make any independent decisions. So the whole thing's an absolute dumpster fire, and I'm sure we're going to get into it as the season goes on, but all I can hope is John Henry read the article I read about Wick Grousbeck and what the Celtics are doing to succeed in the city and follow it even on a minuscule level.
Just real quick, I just want to remind everyone how rare it is to actually get the opportunity to lead the Red Sox front office, because Epstein was essentially installed into that position by Lucchino. Ben Sherrington was essentially installed into that position by ownership. He was Epstein's top lieutenant, and he oversaw the farm system. So there was no wide search for an executive when Theo left. Then you had Dave Dombrowski come in. It wasn't a huge shock, but it kind of came out of nowhere. Don Orsillo announced the hiring like in the seventh inning of a game that first week of August. So they didn't cast a wide search again. They approached Dombrowski. He was the one and only guy they wanted to replace Sherrington. They said after Dombrowski got fired, they would cast a wide search, but reportedly the one and only guy who got an interview was Heim Bloom. So there wasn't really a wide search. So now finally at the end of 2023, they're finally going to do it and interview and screen multiple executives, and nobody was interested. This is the first time in over 20 years that, people could vie for this spot and nobody wanted it. They went with their 11th choice. They went to Breslow because they had nobody else to go to. Jeremy.
Do you know why, Terry?
Tell me.
Because everybody in Major League Baseball knows the Red Sox are cheap pricks. So why am I going to go to a major market city and be told I can't spend? Look what Dombrowski's doing in Philadelphia. My business partner is a Philadelphia Phillies fan, so I kind of keep an eye on him. I am so goddamn jealous of that program. They retain their own guys. They spend outside the organization. They're absolutely loaded. They're fun to watch. The ballpark is rocking because they know that ownership is invested in their program. So they show up and it's like an electric factory. And we are the antithesis of that. Our fan base is a reflection currently of our ownership. And it absolutely pisses me off. Dombrowski is a spend guy. We know that, right? He went and got Sale, and we can go on and on. And at some point, he maybe became something that we didn't need because the cupboard was bare in the minor leagues. But they specifically went and got Heim to be cheap. It's so frustrating because we're so far away. There's no organizational depth. There's no minor league pitching we can count on. You can talk about some of the positional players, catcher, shortstop. We got people coming up. I get it. Fine. But as we sit here right now, we are becoming the 90s Devil Rays. It's absolutely it's embarrassing, and I kind of want to be a Phillies fan.
Literally one last thing for me and then we'll transition, but you look at the 15,000 empty seats tonight. How much did that cost ownership to not have those seats filled when you could have spent $25 million this year on Jordan Montgomery and had at least a better rotation? I know the rotation's been good now, but I don't think it's going to be sustainable throughout the season. But you could have just spent that extra money and the winning would have sold more seats. So it would have offset. You wouldn't be at a loss for spending the money. Now you're getting destroyed. You didn't spend the money, but now the fans aren't spending the money. So it's still a net negative. Go ahead, Jeremy.
Well, here's the problem, Terry. We're not one player away.
True.
So you could spend the money on Montgomery, but it doesn't make us – it makes us what? 2 to 5 wins better. It's a systematic failure. It's not a vacuum like we didn't sign Snell or we didn't sign Montgomery. It's a systematic failure to build a competitive roster and spend money. And the money they do spend is a smokescreen to avoid the fan base, the educated fan base, focusing on what's real and what's not.
I said going into the winter, I said get 2 starting pitchers, middle to high end starting pitchers, and get yourself, a proven right-handed bat. And that's what you need to start the season with. You can be competitive there. And Tyler O'Neill, it's worked out okay, but he's extremely injury prone. He's really only had one good season, being 2021. That was a $5 million salary dump, and we took that on. Liam Hendricks, that was another $5 million that you didn't necessarily need. You know, they just weren't smart about how they went and spent the money. They could have allocated their money a little bit better than how they did it, and then spent, you know, that extra $20 to $25 million. At least that would have sent a message. Okay, we're trying, and it was this joke of a winner. We've got four middle infielders that can't play the position. This is, we could go on and on.
Terry, why not get Snell and Montgomery at the deals they signed?
We would have blown past the luxury tax, but
so
let me finish. I'm okay with short-term deals. I'm okay with, a couple of three-year deals like that bridges the gap. It allows you to develop maybe at least one or two more guys internally and keep you competitive. I mentioned the 2013 World Series all the time. They signed Napoli, Victorino, and Johnny Gomes to bridge the gap, to get to Mookie, to get to Xander, to get to Bradley, who was a highly touted prospect at the time. And accidentally, we won a World Series, you know? So there's nothing wrong with short-term spending.
You know what's important about short-term spending? The ability to bring in long-end talent. How are you going to recruit? How are you going to get people to take you seriously if you're not competitive in the right now? Right? Yeah. Like, how are you going to get free agents, guys? Jason, Terry, chime in. But imagine if you signed Snell to a two-year deal, like he signed, and you signed Montgomery to a two-year deal, which is more than he signed. And then you went out in the free agent market now, whether it be the trade market before the deadline, and traded for somebody to extend, or in the offseason and say, look, we're really good right now. We're a player away. And then maybe you get that type of player. But you're such a dumpster fire, you have no chance for that type of play. You don't. Bright, like, imagine dropping a power-hitting right-handed hitter into free agency. How are you going to recruit them right now? We're not going to overpay. We can't promise you winning. But if you go spend some short-term money for guys like Snell and Montgomery, you all of a sudden have a chance to improve your roster just by winning, or at least having the perception that you can win.
We've actually kind of covered that. In the last few seasons, we've been the runner-up on so many different players. We gave Jose Abreu the same money that the Astros ultimately did, and he picked the Astros because why wouldn't he? Zach Eflin, same exact amount of money to play in Boston, but he chose Tampa for that. So we're getting beat. We're constantly the runners up with a lot of these players because Boston, like you're saying, is not a destination city right now.
That's a good point, Terry.
I know. Although, that's why I said it.
I'm going to take it a step further. I doubt that we were serious contenders for those players. We're always the first to say we're in, but we don't get the details, right? Like Calvin Ridley with the Patriots signing, we knew we were $1 million a year short for 3 years. I crossed sport again. I apologize. But like we knew transparently we were short, right? And people went into the Massachusetts state tax versus, other whatever. But we never know how close we are because I don't think we're ever close. I think a player signs for 5 years, $175 million. We offered him two for 50. I don't think we're serious candidates. We're always runners up. We're always in the story. We always leaks to the press about we were in on this player. But were you really in? Like, were you really competitive? Did you offer real money? Did you actually want the player? I don't believe it.
And that's the thing. It's always easy at the end, to come in and say, "Oh, we were right in. We were in the hunt for this player. We did offer what we believe is a competitive offer," and that's what they always. That's how they code it. Well, we believe it was a competitive offer. It was probably not. It was probably dog food. So,
Jason, if it was competitive, tell us what the. I almost swore. Jason, tell us what the offer was.
Yeah, they don't right? want to.
If Montgomery signed for 1 year at $25 million with a player option, tell me you were at 24 and a half with no option. I mean, tell us the truth. Stop with the bullshit and tell us where you're at so that we have some level of trust that you're trying to build the program. I have no trust. Terry, I agree with you. We're always runners up.
You've been agreeing with me all night.
I know. I'm uncomfortable with it. It'll change next week.
I forgot where I was even going to go with that. So I had something on deck, but it slipped.
Well, do we want to go to my?
Yes, town? Absolutely.
Yeah, let's do it. Yeah, what do you all got?
Right, well, we're not really shifted gears here, guys. So I read an article today. I'm blown away by it. I'm embarrassed by it. I have already said a lot in Jason's clown take on this. But Sam Kennedy comes out because Alex Cora, and we'll talk about this as well, is a good manager. I truly believe it. I think he's a top 10 manager, maybe a top 5 manager. He's won a World Series. You can take certain stock in the whole Astros cheating scandal. I don't take a lot in it. I think every team looks for competitive advantages, and the Astros were no different. Sam Kennedy, scumbag, piece of shit, comes out and says, "I don't know what's going to happen with Alex. I think Craig and Alex need to talk and get to spend some time together this year before we know what's going to happen." We know what's going to happen. Alex Cora is going to leave for a competitive organization with ownership that is committed to winning. And the only chance he's going to stay is if somehow, which isn't going to happen, the Red Sox show that they are committed to winning. We all know Sam Kennedy is the mouthpiece for ownership because John Henry, sackless piece of shit, only goes out for tributes to cry. He doesn't actually put himself in any harm's way whatsoever since the Winter Classic last year when he got booed out of the building during a Bruins game. It is absolutely dysfunctional that this is how we're handling retaining a top 10, top 5 manager. You guys may disagree with me on that, and I'm willing to discuss that. But he resonates with the players. He knows how to manage the game. He's not strictly an analytics guy. He does rely on the analytics, but I think he also relies on, feel for the game. He played. I think it's an absolute embarrassment that we have ownership going through the president of baseball operations to tell us that the GM and the head coach need to have a conversation when everyone knows that Alex Cora is a fit for this organization.
Jason, you go.
Derek. Oh, okay. This is just more of the Sam Kennedy bullcrap that unfortunately we're getting used to. He's just a bad salesman and he's the president of your baseball team. It's just ridiculous. And Jeremy's right. We all know what's going to happen with Alex Cora at the end of this year. He's out of here. He's absolutely out of here. I don't see any way that he stays unless the Red Sox pull off a miracle and, they just completely turn around and he sees some sort of vision where he goes, okay, you know what? Yeah, maybe this is worth investing in, but that's not likely going to happen. So he's going to leave. He's going to leave and he's going to look for a big market team that, as Jeremy said, actually wants to compete and wants to win and wants to spend money on talented players and wants to be in playoff contention every year. Because the Red Sox don't want that anymore. They don't want to be in playoff contention every year. They want to build it their way. And that way right now is, well, we'll have a couple of transition years, aka last place finishes, but just wait. Just wait until the pillars that are, you know, Anthony, Teal, Mayer, wait until these guys come up. Then we're gonna compete. Then we'll be ready to compete. But before that, no. We're not gonna go out and sign Blake Snell. We're not gonna, you know, give a third year to Teoscar Hernandez to bring him in here. No, we're not gonna do that. No, we're gonna stick with what we've got and we'll just wait. We'll just wait until all these prospects come up because they really believe they can do what the Baltimore Orioles are doing right now, where just bring up all the young guys and then they're all going to hit. Like there's all going to be, you know, monsters. And that's just such a crazy way to do it.
Jason, Baltimore was bad for 20 years.
Yep.
It's not acceptable.
Well, in Baltimore it was for a while because they didn't care as much as Boston does. Here it's unacceptable, or it should be unacceptable. But then again, Sam Kennedy knows how soft this fan base has gotten. Because you guys see these same people on Twitter. They're more excited about the Worcester Red Sox starting lineup than they are what's going on with the Major League team. They're more excited about, oh, Kyle Teal went 2-for-2 tonight, and you know, he's on fire so far, and they're not watching the Major League product. Because that's what it's turned into. So Sam Kennedy just being like, oh, Breslow and Cora have to have a meeting. They've probably already had meetings, dude. And they probably are looking at each other going, yeah, you're not – Breslow's looking at him going, you're not the manager I want. And Cora's looking at him going, you're not the GM I want. So it's just – it's an unhealthy marriage, and they're going to play out the string this year. The team's going to suffer for it, and Cora's going to jet as soon as the season ends. And I don't know who Breslow's going to want to bring in. I don't know what type of manager he's going to want, but – Cora is going to go to a big market and he's going to be successful. I think he's a decent manager. I don't know if I'd say he's top five. Is he top 10? He might be. Yeah, I might be willing to say top 10, but he'll have success where he goes because he's going to go to a team that cares. This team doesn't give a crap right now. So, and that's Sam Kennedy just laid it all out there for you. So it's more of his bull crap. He just, you know, again, bad salesman trying to be a president. It's just, I'm so tired of it.
I really believe if they came to him tomorrow and said, okay, we've got a 4-year deal for you with this amount of money, like even a decent amount of money, I don't think he signs it. I don't think he wants to sign it. You know, so many people already have him managing the Dodgers next year. I think that kind of remains to be seen because the Dodgers are one of the most hardcore analytical organizations there is. I saw Dave Roberts in an interview once talk about, they were talking about starting a certain pitcher, I think, in the playoffs. And Roberts was like, yeah, you know, I'm kind of, you know, I kind of like that scenario, but I'm just one vote. So there's other people influencing it. And I don't know if that's the type of front office that Alex Cora really wants to work under. But he saw that Craig Counsell deal. You know, what was it, 5 years, $40 million? He's getting $8 million a year. So Cora's getting paid $3 million this year. So I think he would get scooped up fast. I'm not an Alex Cora guy, but I'll never hate him as much as I hated John Farrell, who I absolutely despised. And you could do worse. I think what will happen, I don't think Veritek's going to be the guy because Breslow's not going to want a guy that's more popular than him. I don't think that wouldn't be a good strategy for him. What it's probably going to end up being is some up and coming nerd that's hardcore analytics that's going to bend over for the front office and or the analytics department and just do exactly what they said. And I would hate that. I would hate that style of managing. I think the manager should have the ultimate say on what the lineup card is. You know, the front office can control who gets optioned and who doesn't, you know, fine. But you could do a lot worse than Alex Cora. The one thing he pissed me off this year about was whichever extra innings game was in Seattle, it was extras. There were runners on the corners with two outs. Second base was open, and J-Rod came up to the plate, and you had Jorge Polanco in the on-deck circle, who was 0 for 3 for the night, having a terrible series. If the winning run's 90 feet away with two outs anyway, just put J-Rod on. He's not only the best player on the Mariners, he's probably the second or third best in the American League, you know, and Cora pitched to him and allowed us to get beat by him. So, I mean, I don't think he's perfect by any means, but
no manager is.
Like I said.
So I have two comments. The first is lame duck managers on expiring contracts never work. Right? They lose the locker room. And how could you not? Like Cassis, for example. He's looking for a long-term deal. He knows that Cora is not going to be involved in that process. He's going to stop listening to him, guys. Now, maybe Cassis is a different personality, but these are professional athletes. They all have egos, and they're all driven by dollars and by dollars. Okay, so the lame duck manager thing just doesn't work, and they're trying to build a foundational season with a guy who's not under contract. It's ridiculous. It doesn't work. Terry, they've offered him 4 years, $60 million. I don't have any reservations that they haven't done that. He isn't interested. He wants to win. The other thing is, I think on some level, he wanted Craig Breslow's job. I don't think he wants to be in the dugout anymore. He's had commentary about this. And I think when he wasn't considered for the position, that pissed him off. He's on a one-year deal. The front office position's available. He doesn't even get a discussion. And then finally, when he does leave, because he's gone, it's going to be just like the general manager. People aren't going to want the job. Same situation. I'm going to go coach a team that isn't going to spend money on the roster, so that it's going to harm my career. It's going to put me in a position to lose. And especially if this is my first time managing, it will ultimately be my last time managing. It's not going to work. They're going to have to find the 11th guy, just like they did with Craig Breslow. And it's not going to work. It's an absolute dumpster fire.
So another thing that happened just in the last, 48, 72 hours, Skip Schumacher's option got voided by the Miami Marlins. And I thought that was the front office deciding that. Apparently it was Schumacher saying, I don't want to be a part of this anymore. So what? It wouldn't surprise me if there's just a mutual parting of ways in June or July. If we go like straight into the toilet and we're 12, 14 games under 500, I could see Alex Cora just bowing out and ownership and Breslow being okay with that. I don't think it's a guarantee he's going to finish the season.
I couldn't agree more, because the way they're trying to save money, right, the way they won't spend, do you think they want to spend any money having to hire a replacement and pay a guy who's not actually managing the team?
Probably not. I mean, I'm assuming Ramon Vasquez would be the guy, the next man up on an interim basis. And that happened with Torrey Lovello in a somewhat similar situation in 2015, because Farrell had stepped aside, and I think they gave him a slight raise for it, but I think Cora's going to just be like, listen, just find someone else to manage. This isn't what I signed up for. And I don't think it'll end up being this toxic thing like with Francona.
But well, that was ownership, not Terry.
No, I know. It was probably Lucchino, to be specific.
Correct. Yeah. I think he was the one that came forward with some of the nefarious commentary about prescription pills and stuff. That was completely unfair. I'll say this last part. I think Alex Cora wants to be here. I think he absolutely loves the Red Sox, the relationships he has with the players. And I think he really, truly appreciates the fact that once he got suspended, he was brought back and was allowed to continue his career, which is going to allow him to go to his next job. The fact that they blanked that up is even more infuriating, because I truly believe he wants to be here.
Well, I think
you guys might disagree with this, but I think he's a really good manager and that he promotes the long-term success of the franchise. And the fact that they're going to let a guy like that walk, just...
yeah,
it's a shame.
I only think he would want to stay under the right circumstances, and I just don't think you're going to get that.
Totally agree.
He'll win a ring with another team before we even sniff a World Series, you know, win or lose. So,
yeah, I agree, and I think it's just a matter of timing, because I agree with you guys. If it happens mid-season, because the Red Sox completely submarine and they're in last place again, it would not shock me, because he's a lame duck manager. He wants out of here anyway. He's going to eventually start to lose the locker room, because it's also a locker room that doesn't have a vocal leader. You know, I think Trevor Story wanted to be that, but it's hard to be the leader when you're on the shelf. Devers isn't there yet. So, yeah, he'll lose the locker room, and I think it's just – so, again, I agree. I think he's done. It's just a matter of, does it happen sooner, or does it just happen at the end of the season? And but either way, yeah, it's – we all know that that's the case. So, it just – you know, it's a shame, because he will have success wherever he goes, but – it's just not the right situation for him here. So with that, I think we've gotten all of our ownership bashing out of the way. So we will wrap it up on that. Again, the Weekend Crew will have you guys on Monday morning to recap this Angel series. And we'll be back next week to talk about the Guardians series, including the Marathon Monday game. So should be a good one. So everyone have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you later. Take care.